How do you come back from an unimaginable loss? It's hard to even contemplate, but when Colin Campbell's two teenage children were killed by a drunk driver, he had no choice. Colin has written a book called Finding the Words, Working Through Profound Loss with Hope and Purpose. And in it, he shares lessons he learned from his own journey through pain. Here's Colin.
Hi, my name is Colin Campbell, and I've just written my first book, Finding the Words, Working Through Profound Loss with Hope and Purpose. I wrote this book after my two teenage children, Ruby and Hart, were killed by a drunk driver. My book is an honest account of my grief journey, and it offers some guidance and practical tools for others experiencing losses of their own. Now, I'd like to share five key insights from my book. Insight number one. Grief doesn't need to be so mysterious. People kept telling me over and over again that everyone grieves in their own way and in their own time. And maybe some mourners find that thought comforting, but I was looking for guidance and that didn't help me at all. I wanted some wisdom or a framework to help me understand what it means to grieve, what was happening to me. Telling me that we all grieve in our own way just made it all feel so mysterious and lonely. But in fact, when I spoke with other mourners, I found a lot of shared wisdom. There was a commonality to our struggles. I don't actually believe we grieve in our own way. We might each avoid grief in our own unique ways, through compartmentalization or distraction or drugs or alcohol or isolation, but I believe the central process of actively grieving is the same for all of us. We all need to find the words to talk about both the loved one we have lost and about our own grief and pain. We need to share our love and pain with other people and have it be witnessed and acknowledged. It's how we process our loss and honor our dead and integrate our new painful reality. Talking about and trying to understand our complicated and overwhelming feelings of loss helps us to stave off denial and despair. It allows us to ultimately accept the painful truth that our loved one is truly gone. The other problem with saying we all mourn in our own unique way is that it ignores the reality that grief is a communal activity. When someone dies, they are not just mourned by their parents or their spouse or children or siblings. A death is like an earthquake. There's the epicenter of loss, but then grief extends out in rings of devastation. It is so important that the people at the epicenter of that loss are connected with all the people who have been rocked by the same loss. They are on a journey together. Their grief is shared. It's the same for joy and happiness. We invite people to our weddings and our graduations and baby showers. Why wouldn't we also invite people to our grief? Sharing both the good and the bad makes the journey more bearable and so much less lonely. Insight number two. Bring as many people as you can along with you on your journey of grief. I remember sitting in grief groups and hearing the same refrain over and over again from fellow mourners, that they had lost most of their friends and family because these people abandoned them in their time of need. There was so much pain and anguish in their feelings of betrayal. These mourners had suffered a second terrible loss and were now isolated and alone in their grief. And I could feel the same thing happening to me. Many of my friends didn't know what to say, and some simply stopped reaching out after the funeral because they were too scared that they might say the wrong thing and accidentally upset me. I was in danger of becoming bitter and writing these dear friends off forever. But the reality is, if the situation were reversed, I would be doing the same thing. I would be holding back, waiting for my grieving friend to reach out to me first. And I would be too scared to talk to them about the person that had died. Many of our friends and family do not know what to say to us, so it is up to us to help them help us. I know it seems unfair that it's our job to educate other people about grief when we're busy being in so much pain, but we're the only ones who know exactly what we need. So, a few days after the funeral, I developed what I called my grief spiel. I would pull each friend aside individually and tell them the deal, that it was okay to talk about Ruby and Hart and the car crash and my grief. In fact, I needed to talk about all those things. I couldn't really talk about anything else in those early days of fresh grief. I wanted to laugh and cry with friends. I reassured them that they couldn't trigger me because I was already triggered all the way. My friends found it incredibly useful to get this kind of guidance from me. It enabled me to have the conversations I needed, and it prevented me from feeling bitter and isolated. If you can possibly avoid it, please don't grieve alone. Insight number 3. Lean into the pain. Don't be afraid of it. Grief is scary. It can feel like if you start crying, you'll never stop, and that if you let yourself feel the pain, you won't be able to bear it. But that's not true. Every crying jag eventually ends, and every wave of grief eventually passes. Sometimes those waves can feel enormous, but you can ride each one out. The pain is so deep because our love was and is so deep. But the pain of grief is natural, and we need to feel it. We can't somehow skip over it or speed it up or bypass it. One way or another, sooner or later, everyone has to grieve. 2 days after the burial, I was in my living room looking up at huge photos of Ruby and Hart. It was comforting to be able to gaze into their smiling faces and still feel their presence in the house. Except this morning, it wasn't. It was scary. I was seized by all the terrors of early grief, and I looked away from their photos. And in that moment, I had a powerful epiphany about grief. I realized that my fears had the potential to drive me away from my own children. I was in danger of running away from everything I had left of Ruby and Hart, my memories and thoughts of our lives together. Turning back to face the photos, I shouted out loud through tears, "I am not afraid of you." I wanted Ruby and Hart's spirits to know that my love was strong enough to handle the pain. I would fight for our love to be felt in my heart, no matter how scary it was. Because if we want to remember and feel the joy we shared, we have to feel the pain too. They go hand in hand now. Likewise, if you numb the pain, you're also going to numb all your other feelings too, like pleasure and happiness. And that's just no way to live. Paradoxically, we lean into the pain of our grief precisely so that we can then be able to let that pain go and access the joyful memories instead. The idea here is not to wear our pain as some kind of badge of honor or proof of our love. Being in pain is not the goal of grieving. Quite the opposite. Our loved ones don't want us writhing in pain. They want us to be able to hold on to all the joy they gave us in life. And in order to feel that joy, we have to allow ourselves to feel the ache as well. Insight number 4. An important part of grieving is wrestling with our rage. We've been robbed. The universe has taken something or someone away from us forever, and we were helpless to prevent it from happening. That helplessness and sense of injustice can fill us with rage. Now, if we don't own that anger and find ways of exercising and exorcising it, we can be in danger of unleashing it on our closest friends and family, the very people we need most on our journey through grief. I wanted to spare my friends, family, and myself from all that anger. So very early on, I began searching for healthy and productive outlets for all my outsized emotions. One early practice of my wife, Gail, was to use journaling as a way of getting the venom out toward people and situations that had caused her pain, either intentionally or unintentionally. Professionally, Gail is a take-no-prisoners comedy writer. Personally, she's a kind, loving person who doesn't want to be cruel or hurtful. Her way of satisfying these competing needs was to devote sections of her journal to something she calls the hate du jour, using it to vent her angry grief feelings via scathing and comedic takedowns of anyone and anything that had pissed her off that day. She got to express her pain and frustration in a healthy and harmless way. I happily joined in. We would often regale each other with vitriolic tirades against our hate du jours, but we were careful to keep our rants to ourselves. We weren't trying to actually cause pain to other people. We were simply allowing ourselves to be petty and mean in the privacy of our own home. It was a harmless, creative outlet of our rage. It got it out of our system. Another, more positive tool to handle the rage was performing random acts of kindness. For example, when I was behind the wheel of my car and feeling my rage building up, I found that if I, say, pulled to the side to let a motorcycle pass, or if I let someone merge in front of me, I would get a friendly wave of thanks, and that in turn helped dispel some of the anger. My behavior was, in a way, aspirational. Even though I didn't feel kind, I was doing something kind in the hopes that it would change my state of mind. And it very often worked. If I acted kind, I started to feel kind, and then I actually became kind. Kindness is the best antidote to rage. I think it's why so many mourners memorialize their dead with acts of generosity. Insight number 5. Say yes to everything, even though you want to say no. One of the most important parts of our journey through grief is the act of re-engaging with life. After Ruby and Hart were killed, I didn't really want to live without them. It felt like I was drifting, untethered and disconnected. Everything was unreal. I didn't like that feeling. It scared me. I knew instinctually that I had to work to reconnect. I had to make an effort if I wanted to one day care about life again. So, in the early days of grief, I decided to simply say yes to everything. If a friend offered to take a walk, I said yes. Or if they offered to take me to a grief meditation or grief yoga or skeet shooting or hiking or a cup of tea, I said yes to all of it. Even though I wanted to say no and hide away in my own little bubble of pain, I said yes. Having a blanket policy of saying yes made it easier for me in my early grief, when making any decision felt so terribly challenging. In the end, some of those activities weren't right for me, but that's okay. I tried them. That's what matters. And it helped me discover which actions did give me some solace and sense of connection. Because in those early days, I felt completely disconnected to any sense of purpose in my life. I trusted that re-engaging with other people would ultimately lead me back toward finding meaning. It was aspirational. In the end, it helped. I think we have to go out into the world in order to find our own meaning and purpose. It begins with other people. But actively trying to re-engage with life after loss is very challenging. Not only do we have to overcome a profound desire to curl up in a ball all alone in our bed, but we also have to struggle with feelings of survival guilt. At times it felt as though I didn't have a right to live a full life, that I was somehow betraying Ruby and Hart and my grief if I allowed myself to feel pleasure or happiness or to even plan for a future without them. Just as I need to wrestle with my feelings of loss, I also need to grapple with guilt and learn to somehow live alongside it. My grief and guilt aren't going anywhere, so I have to learn to navigate them both. And the best way to do that is to stay engaged with life and embrace the challenges. As the renowned psychiatrist and Holocaust survivor Viktor Frankl wrote, "Say yes to life." Thank you for reading. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Colin. That was Colin Campbell with 5 insights from Finding the Words, Working Through Profound Loss with Hope and Purpose. I'm Michael Kovnat. Thanks for listening.